Greetings from K9 to Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum. End of message.
Happy day, faithless sisters, and welcome to episode 177 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm the Cosmic Hobo, otherwise known as Hayden.
And I'm Mark.
What's been happening since last we gathered? My volume 5 of Warp Warp, have yours arrived yet?
Mine arrived, and then it went away again because I wasn't in. So I've got to go and collect it tomorrow.
Talking of Warp Warp, did you see Phil Stevens? I think it was Phil Stevens, made himself a Vesuvius from the Iron Legion stories.
Oh, yes, I saw that. Yes, yes. Yeah, brilliant.
It was extraordinary good, wasn't it? I thought, where have I seen that before? And I thought, elderly, sort of wise robot, wise elderly robot. Oh, and I said, oh, I know it is. I said, Metal Guru, is it you?
Oh, dear.
Anyway, changing the subject completely, Hayden, what have you been up to?
Well, Telegram Sam. I've had a few little Doctor Who trinkets come my way, let's say. Years and years and years and years and years back, way in the wilderness years, I used to have the Bluebird? Dalek? So it was like a Polly Pocket sort of Dalek
thing. Oh, yes. Yeah.
And I thought it had gone forever. I thought it had been consigned to the garbage disposal dump in time that all the 60s episodes ended up in. But no, I was in fact wrong. And in fact, I have brought to the Whoseum this little fellow, look.
Oh! Oh, see, I have that, but I've never taken it out of the packet.
How do you ever expect to play with it if you don't take it out of the packet?
I don't know. It's one of those, because it's in like a sealed plastic, one piece of plastic thing, isn't it? You can't open it up. Oh, that's cute, that little Dalek.
My little Dalek. Look.
Have you opened that, Hayden? I thought we were going to open them all together.
Well, I opened this in 1997, so there's a little bit...
excuses.
As long as it's you've not betrayed me.
But I love the fact that it's a headcanon nightmare, because you've got Remembrance of the Dalek Stavros up the top. I will include pictures in the show notes here, ladies and gentlemen. You've got Tom Baker from Genesis of the Daleks inside the TARDIS, and a Dalek from, I think, the Hartnell years, because it's just the silver little Dalek on like a little rolling.
Like a little rollykin.
On like a ball bear in there, look. Oh, it's so good. I'll bring it along to the Capitol. We can all play with them.
Oh, yes. I might take my 1970s War of the Daleks board game along, actually, and set it up.
Oh, that's a good idea, actually, that.
And if people want to come chat to us and have a game with War of the Daleks with us, that'd be quite nice, wouldn't it?
That'd be excellent.
So I'll bring that along. I believe I mentioned it on our board games, or I think we did a thing where we talked about lots of games, didn't we? I certainly did, anyway.
We did, yeah.
It's the one with the playing pieces, which look a bit more like Harry than they do the Doctor. So I'll bring that along to the Capitol.
Excellent. And I also had another little delivery since the last episode as well, which I'd forgotten I'd actually pre-ordered. And it's these two chappies.
Oh, the Power of the Doctor figures.
Yeah.
From Character Options.
Yep, so I've got the 10th Doctor. Oh, I'm sorry, the 14th Doctor here, as played by Sylvester McCoy.
Yes.
If you look at the... And then we've got... Jodie's 13th Doctor in the... I was trying to sort of work out what some of these parts of the costume belong to. Obviously, the scarf is the 4th Doctor, isn't it? The stick of celery is the 5th.
Yeah.
Jumper's the 7th. But whose trousers? I mean, are they like Capaldi's or... I don't know.
Are those stripes?
I'll leave a picture in the show notes because they're like sort of tartan. Oh, there we go. Sort of picture. Yeah.
Oh, they're Second Doctor then, aren't they?
Oh, how topical of them to include that. So that's good of them. And then yesterday, I got this.
Oh!
Which is, for those who are not in the Whoseum, it is the Complexion Season 24 in the slipcase.
Oh, okay.
So there we go, because I've given up on the chunky ones now. I'm just buying the slipcase versions instead.
I've stopped buying them altogether, unfortunately, just because times have been a bit difficult at the moment, and it's just one of those things I can't justify spending, like, best part of 50 quid on something like that. And now that I know that the disc sets are going to be available either in the limited editions occasionally or most likely in the slipcases, you know, for a long period of time now, then I don't really see the point in breaking the bank to try and snaffle them up as soon as they arrive.
No, absolutely not.
No. I mean, to be honest, that sort of behind-the-sofa thing is the only thing that's really new on any of them, isn't it?
Documentaries, yeah.
I mean, yes, all right, sometimes they have something nice, like they'll put the whole of the Tom Baker years on one of them. But other than that... But since I decided to go for the slipcases, I'm just sitting here twiddling my thumbs. I can't do anything until they release the next one.
Yeah.
And then give it a year or so, and then they release the next one in the slipcase form. So I suppose I could save up.
The slipcases are great, but as with the recent 9 announcement, it sort of dampens the excitement for me because I then think, oh, I've got to wait a year or two until it comes out in the slipcase form. That sort of dampens the excitement, really.
Yes, you have got a long wait before you can get properly excited, haven't you? So, in a way, slipcases are the VAR of Doctor Who merchandising.
But yeah, I did buy the Season 2 box set in the limited edition because I kind of wanted to see it, you know, the 60s one and see how things are. But that's on reserve for Mark. So when I get the slipcase one, Mark gets first dibs on that. So.
Ah, ha, ha, ha. Hey, thank you.
Talking of taking games to Capital 6, what would you say the average level of IQ is of the attendees? I'm just wondering whether Mark could take his Danbury Mint chess set.
No, what would be worse would be the Doctor Who game of time and space, the Games Workshop game with Tom Baker on front cover. I think that's more complicated than any board game known to man.
Is that the one with the character descriptions where it's like mid-30s, attractive?
Oh, no, that's the faster role-playing game. No, it's the Games Workshop one. It's with lots of strange pieces of characters with the names wrong because they didn't have the license to do all the companions' names. So they got like Lola and things like that on it or something.
And Tigo.
Tigo, your favourite.
Instead of Ace, it's Ack.
We can't bring the chess set, can we? Because in theory, it's still on that table in the atrium, made of special, what was it, special foreign hardwoods.
Mixed woods, wasn't it?
Mixed woods, that's it.
Yeah. We can't bring the chess set anyway, because if we do and if we start playing it, then we'll play the game again with Fenric. Fenric might win this time, because we didn't burn it, did we? That's the only chess set we didn't burn. So there we go.
And as ever, faithless listeners, you can find links to photos, videos, and more information on almost everything that we discuss on the Diddly Dum podcast at our podcast blog, which you can find at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com. I thought your, after my Metal Guru remark, I thought I'd throw away the Bluebird. It was going to be a cue for you all singing out, bye bye Bluebird. But all three of us have got one of these Bluebird playsets, and we were planning to do a Whoseum episode where we all opened them at once and started playing with them on air. But Hayden's was in his mum's loft. Mark's is locked away somewhere right at the back of a storage unit he can't get at. So we don't have to do anything until then. I did notice, Hayden, that you totally missed. Shall I give you my cue once more? And so I saw this Vesuvius model, and I said, oh, Metal Guru, is it you? Changing the subject completely, Hayden, have you been doing anything recently?
Yeah, I went to see T-Rextasy.
Oh, it takes a while, doesn't it?
the world's number one T-Rex tribute band.
Honestly?
Yeah.
What a coincidence.
He's approved by the family, isn't he?
He's approved by the family. He wears Mark Bolan's old clothes as well on stage when he performs. It's incredible.
It must be tiny.
I think he's performing Mark Almond as well from Soft Cell quite a lot.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, I think
Gloria
so, yeah.
Jones and things like that. It's the second time I've seen them, but Daniels, the lead singer, comes from a town called Halstead, which was about 3 miles away from where I went to school. So he's a local lad. So as a present for Mum at Christmas, I bought her tickets for us to go and see them in the Empire Theatre there. It was brilliant. We were right down the front.
Did he do Fendal favourite Dreamy Lady?
He did do Dreamy Lady. Yes, he did. Yes, he did. I've actually got a picture of the set list that I can share in the show notes to show everyone. And Metal Guru. And
excellent.
Yeah, he didn't play the Groover, though, which I'm quite a big fan of. But I would have just been doing the Drunken Giraffe to that. But it's funny because that you say Metal Guru, but that reminds me of two things. One of them is that Doctor Who Years video that used to be on YouTube.
Oh, yes.
Because they play Metal Guru over your favourite story, The Time Monster, or one of your favourite stories.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's great, that Rock and Roll Years. That's brilliant.
We've got it in the vault. We have, haven't we? We've got it somewhere.
Someone brought it in.
Was it Mark Atkinson? I'm trying to remember.
Oh, that right. Back in... Bloody hell. Back in July 2016.
Wow.
When Mark Atkinson was guesting on the podcast, we discovered that of Hayden's supreme jamminess in not only liking the Rock and Roll Years, but having had a girlfriend whose father produced it. Is that right?
Yeah, it was her uncle. Yeah, Nick Blower was the... Yes, he was the producer, yeah.
So a good time was had by all at T-Rex City, was it?
It was fantastic.
Honestly, you want to get your mother a birthday present, so you buy a T-Rex to see tickets. I want to get my mother a present. I'd have to go take her to see a Cole Porter tribute band or something.
Well, what else can I say, Doc? I love to boogie.
Mark, what have you been up to?
I started watching a new TV series from 1980 called I Served Them All My Days, Doc.
Oh, yes! We finally finished Sweeney. Well, apart from two films at the end. So we started watching with many, many glimpses of Matthew Waterhouse throughout it. That's been a bit of a giggle.
Yes!
I've got a little thing. Well, just while you said on the Sweeney, do you know in the first episode, John Thor is younger than I am now?
That's the 70s for you. It was a hard time.
I binge-watched Noli, which is RTD's latest thing he's produced about Noel Gordon and Crossroads, and I thought...
Oh, okay.
I'll give it a go, but I think he's finally dropped a huge clanger. This idea that, Crossroads was so bad it was good, things like that, but he Noel Gordon. There's just a joke on panel shows now. But it's really, really good. It's on ITVX, which is a new ITV's online channel. I think it's going to be on normal ITV channels later on in the year. But well worth a watch. Helena Bonham Carter's really good in it. Mark Gatiss's Larry Grayson impersonation isn't quite as outstandingly great as all the reviewers seem to say it is. He seems to be going out of his way not to do it. Whoopsie. Oh, hang on, that's...
That's Frank Spencer, isn't it?
That's not Frank Skinner.
Frank Spencer.
I've got a tenuous link with that programme.
What?
Well, the famous episode with Frank Spencer on the roller skates, that was filmed in a roller skate park in Enfield in North London. And the kid who he knocks over when he's on the rink, or roller skating around, was my dad's best mate.
No.
Oh. God.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yes, Served Them All My Days, which was set between the
wars,
two world wars. And I wasn't sure what sort of thing I'd enjoy. Did it used to be shown on the same afternoon as just before Doctor Who?
Oh, I don't know. It's BBC, so possibly. It's one of those shows that... actually, Mark and I particularly delight in, well, probably for people of younger generations, I don't specify anyone in particular. I don't think of the day, this is very dry and slow, isn't it? But when Mark and I get totally bored with with life, we sync up our DVD players across the miles and chat to each other about what we're watching on Facebook Messenger. No, I don't think it says. broadcast 1980 to 1981. I imagine it's one of these things that was on a Sunday, I think. I don't know.
Oh, well.
So, obviously, Mark, you would have been at chapel, wouldn't you?
Now you've said between the wars, I've got that Billy Bragg song in my head.
Well, yes.
You know the one about, I can't get it out of my head now, that I was a miner,
miner between the wars. Yeah.
I was a miner, I was a docker, I was a railwayman between the wars.
Has anyone had any thoughts about the latest manifestation of one of Shooty's costumes that we saw yesterday?
Yes. Do you know what it reminded me of? Straight away, it reminded me of the costume that Lenny Henry wears when he did the spoof, the Doctor Who spoof in the 80s. It's almost identical, apart from the jump. Shooty's wearing a shirt.
Yes.
God, that's a tongue twister. Shooty's wearing a shirt. Whereas Lenny Henry's wearing like a polo neck sweater in that. But it's literally, apart from that, it's so similar. But I like it.
Oh yeah, down to the tash. Yeah.
It reminded me of the coat that Kananga wears in Live and Let Die. I thought that last night. I thought, oh, that's it. Who? Oh, I can't say that. You know what Doctor Who fans like? They'll assume I'm only saying that because they're both black. It's something to do with the coat. Then I thought, f*** Doctor Who fans, so I'll say it anyway.
I think he looks great. Really good outfit.
Yeah. I think he looks good. I like the look. I really like the look.
I think he looks amazing. If we can phrase that so it sounds slightly less erotic. I think that's extraordinarily good. He's probably someone shooty. You can put in anything within reason and he'll look cool in it.
Mm.
Whereas I'm not sure any of the doctors would have... Possibly Hartnell would have been able to pull that off.
Oh, I don't know about that. There's lapels that you can pull on, isn't there? What's that? Brown leather, Chatterton.
Okay, have we got anything else to mention before we get on to Pat?
I'm literally quivering with excitement about this. I'm doing the best to contain all the joy and all of the exuberance that we are finally doing the second Doctor's era. I mean, it's literally like I am welded to my seat, because if I wasn't, I'd be hopping all around the place like Tigger.
Bouncy, trouncy, flouncy, pouncy, fun, 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 fun. But the most wonderful things about Tigger is I'm the only one.
I'm so excited when you said we were doing a special on Pat. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing all about Pat's most iconic scenes.
So, we turn, listeners, to the main topic of this podcast, which is, finally, we're going to do our retrospective of Pat's era.
No one wants you, Pat.
You think Frank wants you? Mutton dressed as lamb?
You cow! Anyway, you're nothing to write home about. No wonder Roy can't do it.
How dare you!
Oh, flaming will kill ya!
You get off of me!
You take back what you said!
You bitch!
You cow!
Actually, I'm not sure if that's the Pat we mean, computer. That's Pat, off his sender's old Pat. What was her surname?
Butcher.
What was her surname?
No, Butcher, Doc. Come on, you can do it.
Oh, you mean it isn't Pat Butcher? You mean I've gone to the trouble of this Frank Butcher cosplay for nothing, just spinning time, sitting here naked?
To be honest, it's just a blessed relief that you've got your legs crossed.
It is, in fact, the second Doctor's era that we're doing a retrospective of today. Pat Charles, and we have finally closed our poll, amassing your votes, listeners, and have either of you looked at it yet?
No.
Right, well, before you do, for start doing a countdown, we'll do our usual game, which is
guess the nil pois.
Only one story received null point. We've got to guess which. First of all, we'll toss a coin, see who goes first. Heads or tails, Mark?
Tails, please.
And it's tails. Do you want to go first or second?
Well, I'll go first, because I think I know what it is.
First, get it over with, all right. So, Mark, tough question. Of the 21 Pat Troughton stories, Second Doctor stories, which one do you think gained null point in our poll?
I believe it would be the Space Pirates.
Correct. Right, now let's get on to... Do you both want to go into...
I don't know. I quite like hearing it as we go through the...
Oh, right, well...
I like not knowing. Obviously, Hayden needs to know because he needs to prime his Alan Freeman.
As regular listeners will know, we ask you all on various social media platforms to vote your top five stories of a particular Doctor in order. And for every story you put in first place, we give 5 points, second place, 4 points, third place, 3 points, fourth place, 2 points, and I'll let you guess what we give to those you put in fifth place. And then we top them all up. We usually start, shortly after we've finished one of them, we usually start immediately putting out a call for votes. And then it takes us months and months and months to get around to being able to do the next one. By which time we have to put another call for votes and people start voting who've already voted. For this one, well, previously, our highest number of votes received in a poll was for the Third Doctor. But that has been trampled in the dust.
That's incredible.
By the Second Doctor now, which is now the highest poll we ever received.
Ooh. It's the pulling power of Pat. That's what it is.
So, if we'd like to make a start, Smashy, if you're ready, computer, can we start the Top of the Pops countdown music, please? And stand by with the Horn of Rassilon if anyone wants to stop the countdown to enthuse about a story.
Bringing up the rear at number 21, it's Pirates in Space. Space Pirates with a fat old null point. At number 20, Bob Pickers, it's a brand new entry by those lovely boys from the Bay City Rollers. Oh no, hang on a moment, it's just a Tardan army, so it must be the Highlanders. At number 19, we have, on 8 points, the Underwater Menace. And number 17 is Doc Hoom's favourite nightclub, it's the Dominators, with 16 points, not off.
Joint on 16 points, joint 17th, and a kind of joint and 17th on 16 points kind of stuff. It is the wheel in space.
And number 16, just 1 point ahead on 17 points, it is those pesky little ice warriors stuck in the ice. And number 15, on 24 points, we have the Faceless Ones. And on 30 points, in number 14, we've got the little crusty things that you put in your soup. Oh yes, ladies and gentlemen, it's the Crotons. And number 13, on 33 points, it's Fury from the Deep. And number 12, on 43 points, in a bit of a gap in a kind of gapway type stuff, on 43 points with 33 points, is now 43 points in a kind of 43 points gap in a gap type stuff thing going on there. Do stop me, ladies and gentlemen. It is the moon base.
Is that the sound of the horn? I haven't heard that for a while.
Well, the thing is, we've gone nearly halfway through the list and no one's buzzed in yet, which just goes to show...
Yeah, I was thinking that.
...that there's not a lot of love for this era in the Diddly Dum Whoseum, so I thought someone's going to have to buzz in soon. That's just faintly ridiculous.
Is that the Horn of Rassilon we heard?
Yeah, the fact that no one's buzzed in yet frankly astonishes me. And it worries me that I'm associating myself with these non-Trout believers. It's staggering. I think there's a lot of good stuff here, actually, in this list so far. I mean,
do you class yourself as a big Pat fan?
I mean, I don't know what gave it away, to be honest with you. Right, I'm gonna straighten myself for this.
Not in public, please, Aidan.
So far on this list, you've got a myriad of all three seasons, and. I can honestly, hand on heart, say, and this is the reason why Troughton's my favourite, is that I genuinely do not think he gives a bad performance in any story. I think he's exceptional every time he's the Doctor, and it's one of those instances with an actor where they are completely that character. He's completely immersed in the role. To the point that when it comes to Tom Baker, obviously, you can kind of tell if he's not getting on with the director or if he's having a bad day. He's looking at Lala, he's not looking at Louise, he's, you know. Whereas Patrick Trout just seems to just, doesn't matter, just he gets on with it. He puts the story in the show first before him. And he makes really, actually what is actually very weak stories like the Space Pirates, the Dominators, the Wheel in Space. He's so watchable in all of those stories. And there's so much fun there as well. He's having, even if he's not having a ball behind the scenes, and to be honest, there's not much to suggest that he, you know, that wasn't the case, but surely when you've, at this point in the series, they were literally recording, it was almost hand to mouth, wasn't it? They were recording like a week or two before the show was going out. So he's got a real, the pressure is immense, but it just doesn't seem to show. And when you look at this, I mean, yeah, like I said, there are some weak stories, but I would watch any of them for the central performance any day over any other Doctor. You know, there's obviously, I have my issues with, yeah, definitely. I'd have my issues with, as you know, sort of latter Tom era. I have my issues with Collins era, but that's more because of the politics and just the look of the show and the direction they were taking it was just bad. Jodie's era, obviously, none of us really were big fans of, but that it had its moments. Didn't like the Tennant era, even though, again, it has its moments. But Patrick Trout's era is just so fun to watch. And there's stories in there, like the Crotons and like the Seeds of Death, which we haven't actually got to yet, which I could put them on if I was like, if I was ill, if I was having like a sofa day when I was a child, they would be the videos that would go in because I could just lose myself in them. I didn't have to worry about having a cold or appendicitis or whatever for the next hour and a half to 2 hours. I could just enjoy what I was watching. But I think the problem is with this era is fan consensus in the 90s, especially the time I came to fandom, was that the Troughton era was virtually untouchable. And all of these stories that we were told were lost classics and they were the holy grail of Who, as soon as they started sort of drifting back into the archives or being animated, I think it's removed some of the mystique about the Second Doctor. And when I was a kid, you'd look through the television companion book or you'd look in, I don't know, W.H. Smith or HMV or Virgin Records, just anywhere where they were selling the videos and just see such a depleted Troughton line. I think there was only ever 5 Troughton stories released on video, from what I remember. I mean, obviously, everything in season 6, apart from, obviously, Space Pirates, but then you had, like, there must have been a few more. But then there was Tomb, and then you had the Troughton years and the Cybermen years. And it just made his era so, like, so special that it was just so rare that these little snippets of what was a very entertaining, very engaging, very likable Doctor are sort of lost in the mists of time, and you had to sort of grab them wherever you could find them, whether that was, you know, in the library or in a secondhand bookshop or in, like I said, you know, a video shop or something. Whenever there was Troughton, it felt like you'd found a shiny Charizard Pokemon card, or you just found a shiny collector's item. You had to go for it. And I think that magic's always stayed with me regarding his era, but I stopped on Fury just then, and I don't want to second guess, obviously, with you guys, but I do wonder whether the sort of the double-edged sword of having things like the animations being made is it maybe ruins that mystique a little bit, and the more that the Troughton era is becoming complete in one way or another, it's taking that mystery away from his incarnation. What do you think, Mark?
I think, especially with Fury from the Deep, I think you've got a good point there. Because when I was doing my completest rewatch, when I was going through the, especially the first 2 Doctors, and I was going through all the missing episodes via reconstructions, loose canon stuff and audio and what have you, I thought Fury from the Deep was really, really good. And that was even just, like I say, just so you just get the getting still picture. You've got the audio and you get the still pictures that match along with it. And that was enough for me. I got really swept up in the story and it seemed really good. Then when we got the animation, I remember we covered it, didn't we? And I think it was just, it weirdly, almost to me, I think because my brain was doing so much of the work in between the still pictures, and my imagination was allowed to sort of fill in the gaps. And then suddenly, when the animation's there, and the animation is quite, it was really static, wasn't it? I seem to remember saying that about it. I seem to remember saying there's a lot of people just standing there talking, and it felt, I don't know. For some reason, it felt, for me, it felt more arduous, less enjoyable watching the animation than it did watching the reconstruction the first time around. I know that's an odd thing to say, but like I say, I wonder if that's because my brain was allowed to do so much of the legwork between the still images. Whereas like when you got the animation, you're going, oh, right, so this is what you're showing me. I don't know. It's odd.
I remember being impressed by the animation of Invasion, which is one of the early ones, wasn't it? But Macra, Fury, they just did nothing for me.
Oh, I thought Macra was better than Fury, actually. I think Macra's been one of the best ones. Mm. I think it's really good. The fact that I could actually sit down with a housemate who hadn't watched any Patrick Troughton Doctor Who before, and we sat and watched the whole thing, you know, is, and he was quite happy to do that as well. And he enjoyed it. I thought that worked pretty well, actually, the Macra. That is one of my favourite stories, though, so maybe that helped as well.
I suppose, I mean, for instance, Moonbase, or as for some reason during our voting last few days, people started calling it Moonbase. I'm not quite sure why. I enjoyed that because I enjoyed the Target novelisation.
Yeah.
The actual DVD of it, when I saw it, didn't do much for me, really. I suppose it's better than something like the Space Pirates, where we've not got anything. Which probably explains why it's got 0 points, but along with the fact it's such a dreadful story. See, Tomb was one of those legendary ones, wasn't it? And then when they refound it in Hayden's second year, which may have surprised you until you realised that Hayden can actually name Pokemon cards, people start to say, oh, it's also got its reputation. Yeah. And you never know whether that's fans just being smartasses. We hear something that's always been thought to be amazing. I can't give it a review saying it's amazing, because that's not going to cause a stir, is it? I say it's been crap. But I really enjoyed Tomb, but it's one of the few that I did.
Well, I'll say now, I mean, the Space Pirates was an odd...
God, say it now, Hayden. Don't delay, Hayden. Say
it now.
I'll say it now. And I bet not being an attempted Northern accent.
There are some, but there are stories in this that all sort of hold a little special little place in my Doctor Who memory. Space Pirates, episode 2, was the only episode on the Troughton Years VHS, which was kind of watchable because it was really good quality. The other two were like really patchy, yeah. I seem to remember. Even though I really liked the Abominable Snowmen episode, it was like the sound quality was dire, the picture quality was really bad, and then all of a sudden it gets really crisp and clean looking episode from this story, which doesn't really look like it's very good at all. The Underwater Menace, I've always had a bit of a soft spot for it, because I'm really intrigued, so I want to see sort of the sinking of Atlantis in episode 4, and I just think it's a bit of a romp, really. I quite like that one. The Wheel in Space, again, episodes 3 and episode 6 were on the Cybermen the Early Years video. So that had a real... Yeah. I watched that to death. I really did. And again, episode 6, I loved because it opened up with Zoe and Jamie spacewalking into a load of meteorites which are being shot at by the wheel. So there's always this really good start to the episode and quite a lot of jeopardy going on there.
And you'd want to watch that if only to find out what exactly the Cybermen were doing in the hairdressing scene. Yeah.
But then The Ice Warriors was unbelievably exciting. I can't remember how I came about it now. I definitely got it when it first came out, and it was a box set.
It was an actual, it's an actual proper cardboard box, wasn't it, that the video came in, like a, not just like a normal video cover. It was, it was the proper like presentation thing, wasn't it? Because I think, did they find episodes of that quite late on or something?
No.
It was one of the last ones to come out, wasn't it,
The Ice
Warriors? It was a late one.
What they did was they... One of the videos was the 4 surviving episodes and like a 15-minute cut-down telesnap bit for 2 and 3, which I used to fast forward through back in the day. And then the other video would have the Missing Years documentary and then have the Underwater Menace episode 3, I think it was. And then it also had a booklet and then it had an unabridged and unnarrated soundtrack on CD of episode 2 and 3, which was brilliantly spooky to listen to at night. But I used to like put my headphones on and like go underneath the pillow. Oh, I used to, that was great. That was so I've got that as well. I loved getting that. I don't remember how it came about. It Crotons. I did. That was one. That was the last Troughton story I saw, and that was when it came out on DVD. But I wonder if on this list it's got 30 points and it's in 14th place because it was shown in that Five Faces run in the early 80s.
Yeah, I was going to say Crotons was obviously the first Troughton that I ever saw because I saw the Five Faces. And I absolutely adored it. Watching the, particularly the Hartnell and the Patrick stories on that, I was just spellbound. I mean, I still feel a bit weird sometimes when I hear that old theme tune and I see those opening titles. I can almost be transported back to my bedroom in like 1981. Wow. And I get a little shiver.
But what's interesting here is just looking at this list, it's how few of them I actually read in novelisation. I read The Ice Warriors, The Moon Base, Abominable Snowmen, Web of Fear, Tomb, and War Games.
Yeah, I don't have many. I've got The Cybermen, Tomb, The Web of Fear, and The War Games. I've got 4. Oh, sorry, and The Ice Warriors. I've got 5.
If they tried to novelise Underwater Menace, or The Space Pirates, or The Wheel of Space, they waited a long time, waited until I was far too old to buy Target novelisations before they started doing it. So that might be an explanation for that. To be fair, whoever the genius mastermind behind the wiping of tapes clearly had it in for Pat Troughton's era, didn't they? Because it suffered more than any...
It's because Hartnell's era up until...
I mean, Bill Hartnell's almost like a clean sweep continually compared to this, isn't
it? Hartnell up until Dalek's Master Plan was very widely distributed, but by the time that it was being sold worldwide,
season
3 episodes were coming into distribution. Terry Nation had asked them not to, or had done like a cease and desist to sell them because he was trying to sell the Daleks in America. So if the BBC was selling them to the Commonwealth, selling them to the Commonwealth, that was going to harm his TV rights. So he pulled and didn't allow the... I swear Tim Burrows is probably shouting listening to this right now, saying, "No, you've got it all wrong. Stop getting Doctor Who wrong." But he... I swear I read somewhere that it was something to do with him not wanting the Master Plan to go out. And then all of a sudden, you'd go from a jump where you have a story where it's the Doctor, Stephen and Vicky, to all of a sudden it's the Doctor and Stephen. And there's 2 companions who have died, and you've had this whole thing that, you know, I think that confused matters as well. And Troughton as well obviously has the regeneration in there too. And I don't think they sold his era to as many countries. Whereas Hartnell, like season 1 was like sold to like 20 countries, whilst Troughton's was sold to like 5 or 6. It was really, really short. I also think it's the fact that Troughton's run, they were deleting the original tapes, so the original videotapes, really soon after.
Oh, really?
Broadcast, like the Highlanders went really quickly. So that was broadcast in late 66, early 67, and I think by late 67, the original master for that had already gone. So then there was nothing to make copies from, because that had already been, you know, and I think it was the same for a very similar chunk of season 4. I remember looking down that list in the television companion, the availability checklist at the back of it, and seeing Power of the Daleks, none. Highlanders, none. Underwater Menace, 3. 2 and 4 in the Moon Base. Macra Terra, none. And I was like, oh, this is so unfair. You know, this is the Doctor I really latched onto, and there's barely anything left. Obviously, we've got a lot more back now, and with the animations as well, I think it's great because it is filling those gaps, but... like I said half an hour ago now, or when it was, I do wonder whether the mystique of the Second Doctor's kind of been ruined by the fact that those gaps are being plugged.
Having said all that we've hardly butted in to talk about any of these first half stories. Had the Rev still been with us, then as soon as you said at number 20 it's the Highlanders, he would have had it wrestle on his horn then rhapsodised about his favourite story, the Highlanders. So I think we ought to just a salute to an old friend, let him know that. What you're saying about how often you hear that thing, but Terry Nation was trying to sell the Daleks to America. I think one day we'll have to do a special podcast dedicated to examining the success of the Daleks in America. So it's clearly, you know, affected our favourite show so much. It would be unkind of us. Just people seem to have ignored the history of the Daleks in America. And I don't know why.
No, they don't talk about it anymore, do they?
So think of a time when we've only got about 3 minutes to spare and we'll spend that one doing a podcast on the Daleks in America.
I was really shocked that Highlanders was second from last, actually, in the poll. Because I think that's a really good story. And this is another one that I really enjoyed way more than I expected to when I was watching the reconstruction. You know, you often think these historicals are going to be rather dry, and I didn't find it that at all. I found it a really good, fun, exciting story. I'm really surprised at its placing there. But going back to the Crotons and the Five Faces of Doctor Who, I kind of fell in love a bit with that TARDIS team when I saw it. And I still would have that as one of my all-time favourite TARDIS teams. I just love the Doctor, Zoe and Jamie as a unit. And I could watch any of their stories happily. I know I didn't jump in to sort of do a big monologue about any of them in particular when you were reading it out. I more kind of wanted to come back once you'd gone through down to number 10 and then come back and sort of just say, you know, that whole era for me, season 6, I love it. It's one of my favourite, it's one of my top...
They do seem to be having a lot of fun, don't
they? Yeah, it's one of my top 3 seasons, I think.
You got the Seeds of Death where Zoe's trying to hold that door shut while she's surrounded by all the foam. And she's clearly pissing herself laughing while she's doing
it. They do seem so good, which is why it is such fun, which, as you know, I'm sure I'll come back to mention that when we get to the War Games, because if you remember when we reviewed it for the podcast, that made that last episode of the War Games even more heartbreaking for me. But, they do have such fun, and they've got such great chemistry. I think they have that with Victoria as well, but for some reason, I don't know why. Maybe it's because I saw the Crotons first, and I don't think I saw any Victoria stories for a while. Well, there wasn't a lot around, was there? So
there wouldn't have been any. There wouldn't have been any until Tomb in 1992.
Yeah.
So that would have been
She's not really a confident character, is she, Victoria? Whereas Zoe, at least she gets to, shall we say, be proactive, so she can go and say, "Oh, Doctor, you do this and do it in square rooms." Or something. And at least Jamie, he might be even less clever than Victoria, but at least he's got his little funny, Doctor, what's that? Lines to say.
Well, he's got street cunning, hasn't he, Jamie?
Street cunning. And then there's that lovely little scene between the Doctor and Zoe and the Crotons where he's saying, "Now go away and leave me alone. No, come back, what's this? Go. No, it's all right, I know." It's,
Where are you going?
I'm going to take the test. I can't let you go in there alone. What do I do?
Well, sit down and put this headset on and press the button. Press the button!
All right, there's no need to shout. Now go away and don't fuss me. Now come back, what's this? It's all right, I know. Right, fire away, I'm ready.
It's a pity that they disappear. But, Hayden, you know you were saying about how hard they were working.
Mm.
They're putting it out almost immediately. I was just looking at the first episode of The Power of the Daleks was broadcast at the beginning of November 96. Mm. And they just carried on going through the whole of that first series until they hit the 1st of July. They disappeared for July and August. The next series, starting in September, went continuously all the way through to June again. They missed effectively June and July, and then it was August all the way through to June the following year. So it's pretty much like it was in Bill's era. It's not like we tend to think of a series now where it was, you know, it's perhaps it lasts for 13 weeks or something, you know, 4 stories and a 6-parter, or 13 one-parters in the modern era. It was just on and on and on. And I think even that is remarkable. I know we've criticised it. It's remarkable how good it is.
Absolutely. Yeah, because, I mean, and I hate to use it as an example, Mark. No, actually, I don't. I love to use it as an example. You know, you can tell moments in season 17 where obviously inflation and stuff like that have really hit, you know, the special effects, and it is starting to look cheap and tired. And you think, you know, maybe this is because this is in black and white. I don't know. Maybe that masks it somewhat. But at no point can you see that turnaround, the stress of that turnaround on any part of design or any part of production, really. The thing that we're not thinking of there is that they were pretty much doing 7-day weeks because they were rehearsing all throughout the week, recording on the Friday night, having to do a 25-minute episode in a 90-minute space in the studio, not allowed to cut unless there was a huge problem or if somebody swore and then, you know, or that they had a big technical failure, then they'd have to cut. But otherwise, they couldn't reset. They were literally filming it as like a play, almost live. But then at the weekends, they were then going on location and filming location footage as well. So it's amazing to think, you know, it's just this huge demand. And the one time that I'm aware that Patrick was starting to really get ground down with it, I think it was around the time Deborah Watling left. And he was very upset that she left and walked into Derek Sherwin and said, I want to leave as well. And Derek Sherwin said, oh, okay. Yeah, sure. And he was like, what, just like that? And I said, yeah. And he said, what, you're going to let me go just like that? And he said, well, yeah, we can replace you. You know, we replaced William Hartnell. You know, you're not expendable. And I think that kept him quiet for another year on the programme. But truth be told, they were having a hell of a... It's like we said about the Sylvester and McCoy years as well, you know. They were having a lot of fun making that as well. And it bleeds through on the screen. But even if they weren't, you know, at the moments when they weren't having fun, or things were going wrong behind the scenes. I mean, you think, you know, things like, is it the Crotons where that was written to replace a space prison story, which fell through at the last minute, and the War Games was written in the space of, was it 2 weeks or 3 weeks as well? Yeah, to fill in where a story had fallen through. And you just think, this was the BBC. You know, I mean, that's no way for TV to be run, and yet they made it work. Obviously, after this, they dramatically reduced the episode count every year. So the Pertwee season then is on for 6 months instead of 10 months of the year. It obviously makes things a lot easier production-wise. But I think that's because Barry Letts had worked on little bits of The Trout and Era and thought, my God, they're going to kill themselves doing this. So, you know, so we need to put something right here. But this is a monumental era. It really is. So I want to understand more why you two feel more apathetic towards it, really.
It's not that I'm apathetic to it. It's just that I didn't like... So there wasn't one particular episode there that I wanted to pull out and say about this.
Right, yeah.
What I wanted to do was, like I said, once we got through to... Like, just before the top 10, was I wanted to kind of go back and express the fact that I do love... I can sit down any day of the week and watch Crotons and The Dominators. Very happily.
Maybe it was Doc I was picking up more of the vibe on then. But I'm intrigued.
Yeah, possibly.
It possibly is. Well, if I talk about my apathy towards the area, if it does exist, let's do it once we've covered the whole lot. Right, so, Smashy, would you like to continue? Computer, cue the music, please.
In at number 11, just outside the top 10, in a kind of just outside the top 10 kind of way, it is the Macra Terra on 55 points.
What?
Do I hear the horn of Frasilon?
Yeah, hold on now. Hold on, what's going on here? What's this all about? I demand a recount. There's something wrong with the voting machines. Come on.
55 points. Oh dear. Maybe quite a few of the voters have been fooled by you constantly telling us, Mark, that there's no such thing as Macra, and so they just don't consider it.
Yeah, no, it's a great story. I love it.
Well, just to cheer you up, Mark.
Yes.
Brendan from Oz, yes. Brandy Bongos, gave us a 5.
Hey!
Oh, dear, I don't know if anyone else did give us a 5. Even that Mark John... could only bring yourself to give it a 4. Let's have a look. Tom from Hayden's Work gave it a 5.
See, I guess it's one of those stories that a lot of people may have it in their top five, but it may not be like the top four, I guess. So,
I was going to say, if they have, they're not told us.
Well, I think this would be lower had the animation not have come out, or had this not have been an animated story. I think this is actually one where Fury, where possibly because of the animation style, I'm not sure it's the actual story itself, but I think this has definitely benefited, because it did with me, because I remember I had all the soundtracks to the Missing Stories on CD back in the day, and the Macra Terror soundtrack was one that Colin Baker did, and it was it was quite ropey. It wasn't very...
What did he do, the linking narrative to
do? Yeah, he did the linking narration, and it wasn't very clear. And obviously, as you know, I'm a little hearing impaired, so I'm not very... there's certain phonetics I can't pick up on. So I found it a struggle. But actually to have the visual representation there and to have it done so beautifully and to be sort of reimagined in that very sort of grand way, you know, all of a sudden the colony... Mm. In a way, it looked a little bit like Jabba's palace, just nicer, with the desert all around it. So it's, and it was, and all of a sudden, it opened it up as a very fun story. It's still a little unforgivable that they didn't do the rough and tumble machine part, but that aside, the actual story itself, it's fun. It's fun, and the macro are well-realised in voice design, let's say, perhaps.
Those smooth-talking crabs, how I love them.
But it's a fun story.
It is.
And it is weird, because I think, looking down this list as I have just now, and I genuinely, listeners, I haven't looked at this before we've recorded tonight, hand on heart, I haven't peeked. I probably would switch the stories that are 11th and 12th and put them in at 8th and 9th. I think I'd put the moon base and the macro terrarium. I mean, the moon base... You know, it's the 10th planet done better, I think. And there is the mystique. You know how people talk from the 80s? People who grew up in the 80s watching Earthshock talked about the surprise of seeing the Cybermen at the end of the first episode.
Yeah.
Well, I sometimes wonder if the children of the 60s may have had that with the moon base. Because the moon base is an ambiguous title. It's not Revenge of the Cybermen. It's not, you know, or the Robots of Death. It's not blowing the cover. And the Cybermen themselves, you don't see them until, well, they're a shadow on the wall of the... Oh, they kill that man towards the end of the episode. But you don't see them explicitly until the very end, when the James going, oh, no, it's the Phantom Piper, and all that kind of thing.
Oh, yes, because they've cut a hole into the dome, haven't they, and then covered it up with... A few things.
And it's only that in the mid-70s, the surprise is completely blown away, because it's one of the first Troughton stories which is novelised as Doctor Who and the Cybermen.
Yeah, that's one of the first targets I got, actually.
It was a very early one, that, wasn't it? Because I remember the thrill of, I almost had to have a plastic boat by my bed while I was reading this at night. The thrill of what's his name? Was it Hobson fighting his way across the dome? With a tea tray to save the day. hang on. Hello, Diddly Dum, who's him? Who is it? Our local STD clinic. Yeah, how can I help you? You'd like Mark to do a television commercial for you? Okay. You got to read out the script for me, will you? I'll just take it down so you can practice it. Okay. Lip smacking, thirst quenching, ace tasting, motivating, good buzzing, cool talking, smooth walking, high walking, fast living, ever giving. Crabs. Okay. Yeah, I'll put it to Mark and see what he says. All right. Thank you. Yeah, I'll get his agent to call you. Ta-ta, bye. So, we got stopped at Macra Terra, Hayden. Smashy.
Don't blow the illusion there, Doc. Yeah. I know it's a very convincing...
I still wonder whether half people listening in the UK understand the Smashy reference. God knows what people outside think.
I mean, if we can get away with including Mary, Mungo and Midge, then we can definitely get away with getting Smashy and Icy in there. So that's...
Smashy, we stopped at number 11, the Macro Terror.
Into the top 10 now, with a bang and with an abominable snowman on 58 points. At number 9, with a bit of a jump actually here on 96 points, it's the Seeds of Death. At number 8 on 142 points, what a jump up there again, ladies and gentlemen, it is the Enemy of the World. Oh, here we are.
I'm glad somebody blew the horn for that.
Yeah. We knew he was going to jump in on this one.
This is me doing my impersonation of Mark. Well, I just can't believe that it's come that low. I think that's outrageous. This, for me, should have been hands down. Here's going to be my Canadian impersonation again. Hands down. Hands down should have been way out at the top as number one at the Enemy of the World. Extraordinary story. It may have helped that I'd never seen it or even read it until it was recovered on the 50th anniversary. And you consider for years we only had the dull scene in the kitchen, perhaps wondering why Jamie was in leather trousers. But it was such a loss that we didn't see this for years.
Mm.
It would have been so much better for Doctor Who's reputation for diversity if Enemy had never been wiped and Tomb had stayed lost. I think Carmen Munro as Fariah plays an extraordinary character. Largely, I think, who wrote Enemy of the World?
It was David Whittaker.
It was David Whittaker, wasn't it? You wrote quite a few of Pat's. There's no sense at all that she was written as, in whatever script you present, as, and here's a black woman.
Yeah.
Which I suppose made it even more unlikely she'd be cast. Because if they could just cast anyone, someone must, in those days, must have specifically decided, I'm going to actually make the effort to cast a black actress in this. And she's extraordinary. Shall we say there's no... because of that, she's not being acted according to that sort of... Shall we say that generation of men's ideas of what a black person thinks and does. She's got this utterly inconsequential scene saying that when she was a child starving in the street, she used to dream of all the types of food that she could eat. And now she's Salamander's taster and she's got access to all the food in the world. She's got no appetite at all.
Mm.
Well, that's a beautiful thing. And the fact that she's not such a significant character and yet your reaction to her death is, oh, spoilers, by the way.
Oh, you've ruined it for me now.
It's absolutely shattering. Far more than if... What's the woman called who flies the helicopter? The one with the thighs?
Astrid.
She died. And I don't... Not being rude. I'm not sure we would have cared that much, would we? If Victoria died, we wouldn't have cared that much. I thought Enemy was extraordinary. The kitchen scene aside, maybe. Yeah. Brilliant. Anyway, I gave this my... This was my number five... My number one vote. Having said that, we've already reached number 8 from 21 down. And apart from me giving Enemy 5 points, Mark giving Macra 4 points, and me giving Moonbase 2 points for the sake of the novelisation, that's the only votes any of us have cast so far, which is significant, isn't it?
Yeah, I have a feeling that the top 5 is going to be a fairly predictable mix of stories.
Yes.
Because I think there are just are some stories in Patrick's era, however much you enjoy the whole era, I think there's some stories that do just clearly stand head and shoulders above all the others.
Mm.
By the way, Enemy of the World itself was one that I did ponder over. My number 5 was Power of the Daleks, and I did wonder about putting Enemy of the World in there.
It wouldn't have made any difference, Mark. Because it would have taken another 21 points to even move it.
No, but I'm just saying that it is such a really good story. I mean, it would probably have been 6th for me, I think, Enemy of the World. I remember watching it for the first time, and I didn't know the story at all. And I too, was sort of fairly flabbergasted. And just the audacity of that narrative twist. I was like, what? How have we ended up here? It's just really, it genuinely surprised me. Some people are like, oh, it's a rubbish twist. Some people just like to do stuff down all the time, don't they? But I thought, thought it was great. I'm very fond of this episode, actually. It's very good.
I've seen it on the big screen at the Prince Charles Cinema in Leicester Square. When Enemy and Webb came back, they did a double header there.
Oh, yes.
And it was brilliant watching the entire story on the big screen. And that Troughton title sequence on a cinema screen. Wow. Loved that as well. But just hopping on to what you said, I mean, I know we said there's one hell of a gap between Caesar Death in ninth place and then the Enemy of the World in eighth place. You've got 96 points and 142 points.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. I would have to say, in my opinion, like with Mark, I could watch any of these. Genuinely, I could put any, this is an era, I could put anything on and I'll thoroughly enjoy it. But if I'm watching it for story and for the quality of the plot and the quality of the narrative, I would say everything probably from Enemy upwards, including Enemy, sorry, Enemy, then everything above Enemy in this list, is really, really strong Doctor Who. Like, really strong Doctor Who.
Hmm.
And this is kind of reflective. I remember the first poll I ever saw where they ranked all the stories was DWM, but it was like 280 or something like that. And it had in the top 10, it had The Evil of the Daleks, Tomb of the Cybermen, and The Web of Fear. And then in the top 20, there was a further three or four Troughton stories, I think, from what I remember, where there was... I know Tomb was in the top 10 as well. So almost half of the top 10 of this poll from 1998 that DWM carried out was Patrick Troughton episodes, which just showed just how strong they were. There was no Pertwee, from what I remember, in that top 10 at all. I think I had McCoy. I think Remembrance was in there. Caves was in there. And the rest of it was Tom Baker.
Are we talking about the Mighty 200?
No, it was before then. It was 1998, it would have been. Can't remember what the poll was called now. And you've just reminded me, looking at our poll, you know, seeing that obviously Enemy has done so well since it came back because it's complete, so we can see the whole thing. We can see the kitchen episode, as you say, in context, you know, with the rest of it now. And it's also a bit of an outlier as well. It's one of only three Patrick Troughton stories as well that doesn't have monsters in it.
Hmm.
And interestingly, the other two have come in the last two places, the Highlanders and the Space Pirates. I'm counting the fish people as monsters here, but if you want to pick hares, then you can say Underwater Menace as well, I guess.
Yeah. War Games technically hasn't got monsters in it, so it's got aliens but not monsters.
Well, I don't know, that depends on your opinion of what makes a monster, but there you go.
It was the DWM Awards in DWM 265, which came out in June 1998. So let's see what they gave. Power of the Daleks came 18th, The Invasion came 16th, Web of Fear came 10th, Evil of the Daleks came 9th, and Tomb of the Cybermen came 8th. Hello, Diddly Dum Museum. Oh, really? Oh, gosh, guys, it's the National Association of Librarians. Yes, how can we help you? Can we get on with it, please? You're anxious to know which story got Hayden's number one vote.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, right, okay. Right, we better get on, Smashy.
At number 7 on 163 points, it is The Mind Robber.
Here he goes again. That never gets old.
You never get tired of the horn, do you?
No.
Oh, that's distracted me. So... Mind Robber is... I love this story. It's one of my favourites. It's weirdly, I think it's one of the stories that I have seen most of all for some reason. I think it's been repeated a couple of times on telly. Then it was one of the stories that I would put on to show my non-Doctor Who friends, particularly if we were having a bit of a night or something, you know, a few glasses of wine and whatever else. And... you know, stick that on, and it's just, people would be. It was fascinating enough for people who weren't into Doctor Who to just enjoy it for what it was, this sort of whimsical odd story. I mean, it does work as a standalone, really. You know, people obviously recognise the TARDIS, go, oh, it's TARDIS, it's Doctor Who. But I don't think people realise quite how trippy Doctor Who could get, if you like, surreal. And especially that first episode. That first episode is an absolute tour de force, isn't it, really? I've seen a lot of people saying, oh, Mind Robber is that first episode's great, but I'm not so keen on the rest of it. But again, it's that TARDIS team, and it's Zoe's great in it, and Jamie's great in it. And the inventive way they dealt with Jamie missing, with Fraser Hines not being able to perform 1 week. I just think it's great. And also, it's notable for the fact that I think it was repeated on BBC Two during the 90s.
It was, yeah.
It was mid-90s, would it be? 96?
It was part of the rerun thing that went between 92 and 93.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it was the Troughton story, because it went Time Meddler, then Mind Robber. And I only know this now because recently I saw on YouTube that there was an advert for Thunderbirds, and then it was followed by The Mind Robber on BBC Two.
I wonder if it was shown a bit later. When did they do the showings that had, like, the Green Death and stuff?
That was 94. Because that was...
Right, see,
yeah, 2 years
I'm wondering
before the video
if
came out.
Mind Robber was shown again later on BBC Two.
I'll Google it.
But I recall going to my local pub, and I was chatting to a chap there, and... he knew I was into Doctor Who. He said, oh, I've been watching those repeats of Doctor Who. That Mind Robber story is very good, isn't it? I said, yeah, it is. And he went, oh, I'll tell you what. I said, what? He said, Zoe's bum. I just pied in hand, nodded.
Yeah, it was broadcast again. The story was repeated on BBC Two on consecutive Fridays from the 31st of January to the 28th of February, 1992.
Okay, but not after that.
No, not according to this.
Okay, fair enough.
That would have meant that 3-year-old Hayden would have watched Thunderbirds and then gone to bed after and missed The Mind Robber. I'd have been watching BBC Two that night, but I wouldn't have been allowed to watch Mind Robber.
But yeah, it's a great story, and it really stands out as... I think that's the thing with some of these Troughton episodes, and certainly you got it a lot with Hartnell as well, I think. You'll get stories that are just completely unlike any other stories. You know, you do get them. And I think, you know, obviously, once you get into the colour era, I think that sort of becomes less common. But, yeah, I love those early years of Doctor Who where you just get these very odd stories that stood out and were just, like I say, they had no precedent in the series and they were never sort of copied afterwards.
Crazy.
Right, Farrow Smashy.
At number 6, it is the first of a Dalek double header, ladies and gentlemen. Oh yes, at 172 points, we've got The Evil of the Daleks. Then heading into the top 5, we've got Paddy Troughton's debuted on 194 points with The Power of the Daleks. And at number 4 in it, oh my god, I can't believe it, it's just a 3 places far too low here. I can't believe it wasn't number 1. I'm really upset here. I'm going to go cry on the floor, be sick on myself and get hysterical and maybe throw a chair at Doc and Mark. On 231 points is The Web of Fear. And then heading into the top 3, on 242 points, it was once missing and then it was found. Season 5 opener, The Tomb of the Cybermen. And then at number 2 in runner-up spot on 271 points, it's The Invasion. Which means that the clear outright winner is the 10-part epic on 316 points. It is, of course, the swan song to the 60s, the swan song to black and white, and it's the swan song to Messieurs Hines, Troughton, and of course, the great Wendy Padbury. It is The War Games.
Do you know what? That makes me very happy that the War Games finished number 1.
Yeah, do you know what? I'm fairly happy with that too. Genuinely.
Yeah, no, I think as Doctor Who stories go, it is one of the top stories of all time. I mean, obviously it helps that it's so long, but it's a proper epic. And there's so much...
Proper
steak. Popeye, ain't it? And it's just, it's wonderful. And it's such a great end to that era. And heartbreaking as well. Like I said, it's that, you know, as I've said before, it's Jamie, Zoe, the Doctor, just funning about through space and time for all of season six. And they're just having fun. And it's great. And they're always able to run away and get away and escape. And then it comes to that last episode and they can't do it. And they try, you know, they have one last little run for it. And then it's time for playtime to end. And people have to go back home to their real lives. And it's, I think I said on the last thing, it's kind of like the death of childhood in a way. And it's like off they go.
Yeah.
I just find it really moving.
It's almost like when Uncle Terence turns up and says, "Don't dump bodies in the river," all our listeners start thinking, "Oh no, time to return to real life."
I think the presenters share in that feeling, don't we? But the War Games is so symbolic on so many levels because it was also broadcast during the last summer in the 60s. And it's also the... considering we look back now at the 1960s at this very, almost sort of hedonistic, but very free and very, like, hopeful era. But you've got some contrasts that summer that the War Games transmits during, which really is symbolic of a lot of eras coming to an end, not just Doctor Who, but kind of the hippie movement starts coming to an end with two very dark and significant happenings. You've obviously got the Tate murders that happened that summer, and then you've also got Altamont as well, the Rolling Stones in Altamont, where the Hell's Angels were acting as bodyguards and the man was murdered at the side of the stage. You know, it's kind of like that. The darker side of the 60s was rearing its head. And for Doctor Who, like saying playtime's over, the time of innocence was over, really, in not just Doctor Who, but it felt like that last bit of playtime before bed was done. It was done and dusted. It was gone. And Doctor Who was never going to be the same again. The world was never going to be the same again as well. And of course, it's the last one in black and white. It's the last one with Patrick Troughton as the Doctor. It's the one that Stephen Moffat said at the Terence Dix celebration that we went to in October. It's the one where they answered the question, Doctor Who.
Yes.
And really, they could have ended it. And it would have ended there. And it almost did end there, with the Doctor's face melting away and he's just falling through the void. And it's a very spooky ending as well. That sort of, that music, that, that weird sort of humming as he's changing as well. It's just, it's sad and it's spooky at the same time. And it's like, what is going to happen next? How is this ever going to be the same again? And it never is. You know, Mark said about the Mind Robber, that's the reason why stories like that really weren't really done going into the Pertwee era, because that period of experimentation, you know, Doctor Who, the show, and the 1960s was over. Just as the Doctor knew the consequences of running away from his people, the world knew the consequences of, you know, free love and LSD and all the rest of it, and it resulted in a terrible fallout, you know. So it's when the adults come back in the room, you know, yes, and literally do say playtime's over. That is literally what happens in 1969. It's a year remembered for the moon landing, but a lot of stuff happened which was very dark. You know, Brian Jones dying.
Yeah.
As well. Rolling Stones had an awful year, considering arguably their best album came out that year. But anyway.
Absolutely. The Invasion is a story that I had been waiting to get my hands on for years, and I was really excited when I got the...
It's very iconic with that whole picture of the Cybermen walking down St. Paul's. Isn't
it? And the fact that it had... We got the Brigadier in it as well. And when I watched it, I thought this... It really didn't disappoint to me. And it's also got one of my favourite guest actors in it.
Packer?
No.
Peter Halliday.
No, not Peter Halliday. Oh, Peter Halliday is great. No, but obviously I'm referring to...
John Levine?
Yes, no, obviously I'm talking about Kevin Stoney, who's marvellous in it. And I think he's one of the great villains to stand opposite the Doctor. It's one of those great character actors to have opposite the Doctor, and it's just...
Can I make a request? Can we actually do The Invasion at some point this year?
Oh, I'd love to, yes.
Because I think that'd be a good one to do.
Yeah, I would love to do The Invasion.
To review.
Yeah. I do adore it. And the music on it is fantastic. Thanks to Douglas Canfield falling out with Dudley Simpson.
I agree with everything you say, but there's one problem with Tobias Vaughn, which I've never really quite got over, and that he doesn't hold his pen like Mavic Chen.
Wasn't that the title of one of our podcasts?
Yeah, I think it was. I'll hold off on the invasion, because if we do that at some point this year, I'll leap into that with full gusto, because I gave that...
Yeah.
That was my third story.
Let's pencil that in for later on this year, then. That'd be a little treat for us, won't it? And Zoe's so at home in 60s London. It's just... Oh, yeah. It's great.
Yeah, she is.
I'm really pleased that that's finished second as well, actually. It's interesting, isn't it, that Power of the Daleks and the Evil of the Daleks should finish right next to each other there. Almost neck and neck. It's 12 points... Oh, sorry, 22 points. Yeah, no, it's. I mean, I think Power of the Daleks is brilliant. I mean, that's the great thing about them not having Terry Nation doing the Dalek stories this season, is the fact they do two stories where they try something really different with the Daleks. There's a lot more going on. The Daleks are a bit more more complicated plans, and there's a lot more cunning. I mean, for me, I prefer Power of the Daleks, and I remember when I did my watching through and I did the reconstructions. And I definitely enjoyed Power of the Daleks more than Evil.
Mm.
The story was so much more more sinister and more thrilling to me, I think, than Evil of the Daleks. And there's some great scenes, isn't there, in Power of the Daleks. Such a loss not having these stories with us.
Yeah, I agree.
I think if Power of the Daleks existed, it may well be... bothering the war games and the invasion, perhaps, for...
I still think Daleks Conquer and Destroy is the best Daleks chant.
Mm.
So much better yes. than, oh, I obey, I obey, I obey.
Or would you care for some tea?
Yeah.
A few stats. If you look at Hayden's votes at the top of his column, he's almost done the top five backwards, hasn't he?
Oh, yes, I have actually.
Hayden, who we always comment, nearly always puts all 15 of his available points. Fortunately, he's only done 14. Got 14 points this time because he gave the Mind Robber 1 point. Marcus Scarman, our old friend, has got all 15 of his points in the top five.
Oh, congratulations.
Although not necessarily in the right order. So, Mark voted. First, it was the War Games... then Macra Terror, then Mindrobber, Invasion, and Power of the Daleks. Top was Enemy, then Tomb, then Web, then Moonbase, but only because I like the novelization of the Tea Tray, and Mindrobber. Although I will say that Moonbase is the story that made me start disliking Ben, because he was so nasty to Jamie. Oh, you're trying to impress Polly, are you? I really punched him when he said that. And Hayden gave Web 5, surprise, surprise, Tomb 4, Invasion 3, War Games 2, and Evil 1. So Season 4 got 23% of the votes, Season 5, 34%, Season 6 got 41% of the vote, so increasing, but not any great gaps between the three.
Mm.
Oh, we said we'd say about what my beef is against Pat. I don't have a beef against Pat. I like him, but I don't see... Yeah, yes, to a certain extent. I mean, I love the things like in the Crotons. Come back, watch this. No, go away, I understand. And the silly things like holding hands with Jamie and Tomb and that. But I don't get this repeatedly Doctor Who actors coming in and saying, oh, I think Pat's the best actor in the history of the show. Or rather, the history of the show as the Doctor. And I think it's interesting that they seem to say, not just that, but the best actor, therefore he's the one I'm going to base my performance on slightly. And I wonder if it's because he is, to some extent, his performance is quite full of mannerisms, both verbal and physical. You know, in the same way that John would always rub the back of his neck with his hand when he was mystified about something. And I wonder if they're thinking, oh, here's a very... I wouldn't say mannered performance, I don't mean it like that, but he's got lots of little mannerisms in his performance, Pat, which I wonder if they're thinking, oh, that's going to be easier to latch onto. Whereas they can't really go around holding their lapels going, can they? I mean, I know, I've said this before, and I know it sounds as if I'm just favouring my Doctor, But I still think that, with the possible exception of Peter Capaldi, I still think that Tom is out on his own as the best actor of all the Doctors. I don't mean in the sense that it's my favourite era or my favourite Doctor, just the acting. I think it's extraordinarily good and varied. And so Pat's performance doesn't do a great deal for me. The presence of Victoria just spoils about a third of the era for me. Just that constant, doctor, just genuinely annoys me. And the fact that there is so much missing. And so there's nothing where I'm thinking, it's not, I'd never watch that, it's a load of rubbish, and as I might do with the sixth and seventh Doctors. It's just that it's, I've watched them all, and there's not much that draws me back. Tomb I watch on a fairly regular basis, although that's largely for their design. But it might only be once a year. Enemy I will. A Snowman is now back in fully either the episode or the animation, isn't it? But the others doesn't do anything for me. And so while I admire Pat's acting performance, it doesn't blow me away. Although one has to salute its high point in Enemy, I'd recognise what we always say, that for any successful show, you'll find that Doctor Who always did it first. Witness Pat's superb Mexican accent.
Hello, Dave. Is that Dave? Dave there. My wife would like to use your toilet.
And so, as I say, while I admire Pat's acting performance, it doesn't especially blow me away. There we are. Maybe I've just got no taste.
That's fair enough. I mean, I don't agree with a lot of that, but that's fair enough. That's your opinion.
I always got the impression that Patrick Troughton was like the actor's actor, if you know what I mean. He seemed to be admired by a lot of the other actors who did Doctor Who.
Yes, I mean, yeah.
I always felt Tom Baker was playing Tom quite a lot in the role, and I don't necessarily think if you're playing yourself in the role, I don't think he's the best actor to be the Doctor. I think he's one of the best. He said so himself, didn't he, in an interview?
You see, I think in a way that's exaggerated there, or has become exaggerated, to the point where perhaps the notion that Tom is just playing himself as the Doctor is now beginning to verge on a cliché. Rather than Tom playing the Doctor as himself, it might be more accurate to say that it's Tom himself who has become a version of his own Doctor at its silliest. And there is a tendency to interpret Tom is just playing himself as the Doctor as being, well, Tom's silly, Tom's Doctor's silly, therefore that's logical. There's stuff like, would you like a jelly baby? Or, oh, what a wonderful butler, he's so violent. That's very Tom. But you could equally class some of his real tour de force acting in the role as being just another side of Tom. If you've ever listened to a serious, i.e. non-Doctor Who interview with Tom, where he is being serious, he's entirely different from the silly Tom that we're all aware of. And I suppose the closest you get to a serious interview online is probably his In Confidence interview with Laurie Taylor, where he's talking about things like the novels of Saul Bellow and Philip Roth. Links in the show notes, as ever.
I mean, isn't he on record, though, saying, I didn't know how to play Doctor Who, so I just played him as Tom Baker? Whereas I think Patrick really was... I mean, I saw an interview with Michael Troughton once when he said... I think it was Toby Haydock was interviewing him, and he said, is there elements of your father that you saw when you were young? And he said, there's tiny flashes, but he said, actually, no, he's very different as the Second Doctor. And I think it's that whole thing with...
But he was very much a character actor, wasn't he?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what I was about to say. You know, there's that story about Fraser Hines was invited onto a talk show and wanted Patrick to go on with him because he said, they don't want me, they want you. And he said, No, because when I take the bow tie off and I, you know, slick my hair back again, I'm me, I'm not that.
It's not me, yeah.
It's not me, yeah. And I always quite admired him for that. But I always found he's the naughty uncle, you know, and that he is, to me... I genuinely don't think I'd be doing Diddly Dum, and I probably wouldn't be a Doctor Who fan if I hadn't have got the Troughton Years video out of the library, or...
Oh, well, that's brilliant.
The second book that I... The second target book had been the Cybermen. or if I hadn't have latched on to the impossible.
I mean, we do tend to avoid on Diddly Dum avoiding saying, oh, I'm right, you're wrong, isn't it? It is generally, oh, this is what happened. I'm not saying, I think he's rubbish, or, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. It's just, it doesn't do anything for me.
Oh, no, I understand that.
And I think although you can, like the commentary on Little Britain, that's very, you think, oh, that's very Tom, in the way that you think that a wonderful butler who's so violent is Tom. But when Tom's at his height during his era as the Doctor, I think his acting, not just his performance and his popular, his acting, blows away most of the other actors who have been in the role. I've mentioned so many times the fact that he's one of the few Doctors I've ever come across who manages to handle technobabble.
Or make it sound natural.
He makes it sound natural and conversational. And, of course, you could equally argue that when Tom is being himself, that too is largely a performance. And a brilliant performance at that.
I would never, ever, ever say to anybody you're wrong for having a different favourite Doctor to me or who you think's the best, but I actually genuinely, Pat has been my favourite for 25 years and Tom's been my second favourite for an equal amount of time.
Mm.
You know, whereas then after that it's kind of like, I'd say probably Matt Smith, Peter Capaldi are probably jostling for third. Which is interesting, actually, because there's three out of those four actors are the three that you've mentioned tonight, Doc, so that's...
Yeah.
That's interesting, but it's, it's personal taste, but for me, Troughton was the hook that got me into it, you know, and I wouldn't be sitting here now with the, you know, 14th and Doctor action figure next to me, or the collection season 24 box set, or my Bluebird Dalek, if I hadn't have got so hooked on the second Doctor.
Mm.
The imagination, I think having to fill in the gaps in my head as a kid from what was missing as well, may have nurtured a bit of my creative...
Yeah.
Turn as well, which may have, you know, I think I wrote this in the book, in Child Out of Time, I wrote about, you know, how I think the Troughton era was one of the sparks that started off my writing. So, yeah, I'm indebted. Just going back to Pat for a second, I think, you know, the fact that he was always seemed in the classic era to be the Doctor they'd call back if they were doing a multi-Doctor story, he always seemed to be sort of the first choice to go back.
Mm.
You know, and extending to something like the Five Doctors, he's fantastic in that. Fantastic in the Three Doctors. Two Doctors, I'll leave that for when we do the Sixth Doctor retrospective sometime in 2026. But, you know, it's, I just love him, and I love this era.
I think with Patrick as well, and I think it's the same with Hartnell, it's particularly a shame with the missing episodes and having to have animated things, because I think both Patrick and William, actually, when you watch the performances that we've still got, you see that they both add quite a lot physically to the role in their mannerisms and little things they're doing off camera and just little movements. And like I say, that was very noticeable when episode 2 of Evil of the Daleks was animated, and you could you could watch an animated version and it wouldn't have hardly any of the charm of the actual televised bit. Mm. You know, when they're in that, when they walk into the antique shop and stuff, and they're walking around the antique shop, there's all that physical stuff between Patrick Troughton and Fraser Hines. And obviously that's not there in the animated version of that episode. And you think how much we've lost. And I think both Patrick and Bill were great with that kind of little extras that they threw in to just, not just reading the script out convincingly, but, you know, in the whole physical performance.
I definitely think that the animations are—they're there as a sort of safety net.
Maybe.
You know, they'll never be able to replace or approach it. So, given that for some bizarre reason Johnny Dab sent us his votes in French, I think, given he went to the trouble, I think we ought to read them out. So. Bonjour, I'll try and do this in my smashy voice. Bonjour, diddly dummers. Ici le vote du ménage Dab. Right, you've got to try and guess each time, guys, which story we're talking about, okay? La cinquième place, avec un point, revient à La menace sous-marine.
Underwater menace.
How well done. La quatrième place, avec deux points, revient au domino.
Dominators.
Well done. La troisième place avec trois points revient à la toile de la peur.
Sorry, can you say it again?
La toile de la peur. Hayden.
It's the web of fear, isn't it?
Well done. Well done, you said, after waiting 5 minutes. La deuxième place, about 4 points. You went, Pouvoir des Daleks.
Oh, I had no idea. The pepper of the Daleks.
Pouvoir, not poivre. Power of the Daleks. And la première place, Abominable Bonhomme de Neige.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, Abominable Snowman.
Unfortunately, he then lets us all down by giving us a translation into English. I've never been so patronised in my life. How dare you? Right, have we got anything else to say about Pat's era?
Oh, I haven't.
No, I think we've wrapped it up now, haven't we?
Well, Hayden, have you got the remaining pieces of paper in the hat for the next...
Yeah, I have, actually. Yeah, hang on, let me just have a look through. There's two in here, actually. Let's have a little go. Russell. Oh, look at that. It's the sixth Doctor, Colin Baker, next.
He's not. Well, I think we'll be spending most of our podcast on that, doing the game. Now, which one's got new points?
Will we get a top five? I don't know. We'll actually have to tune in and find out.
Oh, you'll upset some of the listeners.
Oh, look who's come to say goodbye to us going down the corridor. It's the Sons of Skaro. Dalek Skaros, have you come to give us some advice on sound environmental practice?
Emergency regulations, please do not dump babies into the river.
Dalek Ray, we have a little box propped up in the kitchen with a piece of cheese under it.
It's a trap!
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye, everyone.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at Diddly Dum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk.
Diddly Dum! The empty space that circles time!